This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents You Are Your Best Thing. Vulnerability, Shame Resilience, and the Black Experience. Edited by Tarana Burke and Brené Brown. Featuring essays by Jason Reynolds, Austin Channing Brown, Tanya Denise Fields, Kiese Makeba Lehman, Prentice Hemphill, Tracy Michelle Lewis Jiggets, Mark Lamont Hill, Kia Brown, Lovey Ajayi Jones, Sean A. Ginwright, Kaya Nadira, Duran Young, Sonia Renee Taylor, Irene Antonia Diane Reese, Yolo Akili Robinson, Laverne Cox, Jessica J. Williams, Aiko D. Bethia, Imani Perry, and Tarana Burke. With an introduction read by Tarana Burke and Brené Brown.
Setha, he says, me and you, we got more yesterday than anybody. We need some kind of tomorrow. He leans over and takes her hand. With the other, he touches her face. You your best thing, Setha. You are. His holding fingers are holding hers. Me? Me? Toni Morrison, Beloved.
Introduction.
A conversation.
So we could start the story of this book when you texted me to ask me if we could talk, and I thought you wanted to continue our ongoing conversation about wallpaper and landscaping. But what came before that? When did you get the idea for this book? When did it come to you?
It was after we did Share the Mic on social media in the summer of 2020. There had been this intense public unrest happening in the country after George Floyd and Breonna Taylor were murdered. In private, I was having these really heartfelt conversations with Black folks who were just struggling. Like, I can't watch any more of this. I can't take this anymore. I cannot. And in public, the conversation was, how can we get white people to be better? How can we get white people to be anti-racist? Anti-racism became the order of the day, but there was no focus on Black humanity. I kept thinking, where's the space for us to talk about what this does to us, how this affects our lives? And so I was thinking to myself that I really wanted to have a conversation with you. At first, I struggled to text you. I kept asking myself, why am I hesitating to reach out to her? We have a close enough friendship to talk about anything. Your work is so important to me and my experience as a human being. But as a Black woman, I often felt like I had to contort myself to fit into the work and see myself in it. I wanted to talk to you about adding to it. What is the Black experience with shame resilience? Because white supremacy has added another layer to the kind of shame we have to deal with and the kind of resilience we have to build and the kind of vulnerability that we are constantly subjected to, whether we choose it or not. So yeah, I called and I said all of that, but I was not as eloquent at the time. I will never forget that phone call. I texted, can we talk? And you texted back, sure. And once we got on the phone, I shared the idea. The first thing you said was, oh, hell yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yes, I want to talk about that. Yes, I want to do this. At that point, I was just thinking, oh, and here I was worrying about offending you and wanting to have a real conversation. So that was the beginning from my side. What was happening on your side?
From my side, admittedly, I'd probably do anything you asked me to do. But the timing was bigger than us. I had really been grappling over the last couple of years with trying to figure out how to be more inclusive, how to present the work in a way that invited more people to see themselves. You know, the last thing I ever wanted to do was put work in the world around shame, vulnerability, and courage, then make people feel like they had to do something extra to find themselves in it. You know, I thought I had controlled for that with my sample because I've always been hyper-vigilant about diversity in the people I interview and in the data sources. In fact, one of the earliest criticisms of my work was that the sample population actually over-indexed around Black women and Latinx folks. But I started to get comments, especially from Black women and men. Comments like, you know, I'm having to work at this more to see myself in it, more than I would have preferred or more than I would have liked to have to do. Finally, it was the combination of a conversation with you and a conversation with Austin Channing Brown on her TV show, where I thought, the problem isn't the research. The research resonates with a diverse group of people because it's based on a diverse sample. But the way I present my research to the world does not always resonate because I often use myself and my stories as examples, and I have a very privileged white experience. That was a huge aha for me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, one of the things that struck me was in The Gifts of Imperfection, there's a scene where I'm in sweats and I have dirty hair and I'm running up the Nordstrom escalator with my daughter to exchange some shoes that her grandmother bought her. Immediately, I'm overwhelmed because I look and feel like shit and there's all these perfect-looking people giving me the side eye. And just as I start to go into shame, a pop song starts playing and Ellen breaks out into The Robot. And I mean full-on, unfiltered, unaware, just sheer joy. And as the perfect people start staring at her, I'm reduced to this moment where I have to decide, am I going to betray her and roll my eyes and say, you know, Ellen, geez, settle down? Or am I going to just let her do her thing and be joyful and unashamed? You know, I end up choosing her and actually dancing with her. And it's a great story about choosing my daughter over acceptance by strangers. But I've shopped enough with Black friends to know that if I was not dressed up, even if I was dressed up, and I was in a department store where my Black daughter broke into a dance, there would be a whole other set of variables to consider, including being hassled by security, possibly separated from my daughter, even arrested. So when you asked me if we could focus the work through the lens of the Black experience, it was a hell yes for me. I want to figure out how to better serve. In addition to telling my story, which I think is helpful, I want to co-create so people see themselves in the work. Co-creation is how we can tell stories from the Black experience that illustrate the data. I mean, does that make sense to you?
It does. This is our first time really digging into your grappling with this. Your questions make absolute sense, and it also makes sense why you wanted to do this together. You still said, "Are you sure you want me to do it with you? You have my permission to use my work and do it."
I know. I was scared. I'm still scared.
No, I get it. I understand the fear. And I know we have to be prepared for the question about you being the editor of a book about Black experience. But there's nobody I trust more, particularly on these topics, who has studied them more and who cares more. It's not just the research piece. There are other people who study these topics. But you can combine the research expertise with compassion. You are, this sounds really corny, an embodiment of your work, of the research, of the knowledge. I think it takes the eye of somebody who has done this level of research you have done and who cares about other people's stories. I feel such a sense of responsibility and protectiveness about the stories we've asked people to share for this anthology. We have to be good stewards of this information. So I definitely get the fear and reluctance, but I believe good stewardship takes both of us. I know as we read these powerful essays, we both took turns feeling a little overwhelmed with the responsibility of protecting them.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I've been doing this work for 25 years now. I know the stories in this book can change, even save people's lives. It's an honor to do this with you, honestly. I've been a shame and vulnerability researcher for a long time, but not any longer than you've been an expert in the work, too. I mean, you've been teaching and training this work for decades. We both used the word shame long before most people could stomach it. They were experiencing shame, of course, but we were naming it before most people were willing to do that.
I just remember this feeling washing over me again and again and thinking, this shame is going to kill us. This shame is going to kill us. Being at family gatherings, being at cultural gatherings, watching the young people I worked with, knowing what they were like in our private spaces when they were open and free, and then watching them in public spaces and saying, oh my gosh, this is going to kill us. And then this idea of shame resilience added another aha, because my first thought was, oh, but shame hasn't killed us yet. Then I started asking myself, Well, why hasn't it? I've learned it's because there's this powerful resilience that we've tapped into but have yet to name.
Yes. Yes. And my hope is that co-creating this anthology with these incredible storytellers and writers helps us name it. There's one thing that I think is important to clarify about our process of working together, especially for other researchers and creators who are thinking, okay, but how does co-creation actually work? For starters, I wouldn't have done the book without you agreeing to be the first author.
I didn't understand that at first, but I get it now.
I mean, for me, here's what we have to understand. In co-creation, lived experience always trumps academic experience.
I don't know. Is that a rule? Like an academic rule?
No, but it should be. I guess it's definitely my rule.
I was about to say, that has to be a Brené rule because I don't know that all academics would agree. But I agree that you can't make your research useful to people, accessible to people, if you don't prioritize lived experience, relevance, and accessibility.
Yeah, lived experience has got to take the lead, unquestionably. And I think in co-creation projects, lived experience should not only take the authorship lead, it should take a financial lead where it can, which is why all of my proceeds from this book are going back to storytellers in the Black community.
I think that's dope. But when I think about co-creating, the construct that I didn't fully grasp until I read your book was vulnerability and the role it plays in our lives. My lived experience told me that the entire idea and experience of vulnerability feels like a very dangerous place to play, an unsafe thing to even consider or think about as a Black person in this country. As I read your work about vulnerability being the foundation of courage and the birthplace of love and joy and trust, these are the places that didn't fit. I was forced to contort myself and try to understand my reaction of, oh no, vulnerability means something very different to me. That was a big learning for me, just naming vulnerability and talking about it and thinking about it.
You know, this is the bones of it. What you just said is the bones of it. I believe the greatest casualty of trauma, including white supremacy, which is definitely a form of intergenerational systemic trauma, is that vulnerability becomes dangerous. I mean, risky, even life-threatening. But here's the painful piece. It's not like if you're Black, you don't need vulnerability to experience joy, belonging, intimacy, and love. It's that we've created a culture that makes it unsafe for you to be vulnerable.
Exactly. That's the rub right there.
Yeah, it's not like you need less of it. It's just that we've created a world where you're afforded less.
Exactly. And this is why I feel like this book is so critical. Our humanity, our individual and collective vulnerability needs and deserves some breathing room.
Oh God, that's so beautiful.
We need to live in an anti-racist society and people need to learn to be anti-racist and practice anti-racism. But I do not believe your anti-racist work if you have not engaged with Black humanity.
Oh my God, will you say that again?
I don't believe your anti-racist work is complete or valid or useful if you haven't engaged with Black humanity. And so to that end, I feel like the audience for this book is first and foremost Black people, right?
Absolutely.
These pages are a breathing room for our humanity. I learned so much about the Black experience reading these essays. It's not like Black people don't have anything to learn about the Black experience. Our experiences are vast and different. It's validating to see that even in our own various identities and experiences, we engage in similar struggles. We have the same needs. And as other people engage with the book, it's about seeing the breadth of our humanity and the depth of it. Because this is the reality. It comes back to compassion and love. Always love.
You know, when I read the book as a whole, it was very, very overwhelming for me. Was it overwhelming for you?
Yes.
I mean, yeah, just as each essay came in.
It takes your breath away.
I kept thinking when I was reading about Bell Hooks' concept of lovelessness and how she talks about lovelessness as the root of white supremacy and the patriarchy and all forms of oppression, and that the answer to lovelessness is love. I've read Bell Hooks for 30 years, but these essays and the process of co-creating with you taught me what love in the face of lovelessness really feels like. I mean, the marrow of it. You know, when you say, I don't trust any anti-racism work that doesn't embrace and see our humanity, I can feel the call for love. I mean, I get it so fully right now. It's like you're telling us that if you don't see the heart and the love and the humanity and the joy of the Black experience, of Black humanity, then the anti-racism work is bankrupt.
Exactly. It's just like knowing something intellectually, but not feeling it. And this is feeling work. It's heart work as much as it is head work. These two things have to be in tandem. And I love that we have the ability to make this offering to Black folks who have felt stifled in this moment and overwhelmed and have not had space.
So is your hope, or was your hope for the book then, that it lands in the hands and hearts of Black folks who have had that experience that you've had where you're like, oh my God, there's language for this, there's words for this, I'm not alone?
Absolutely. I haven't read many books about the Black experience that get past some of the first layer stuff and really get into the heart work. And I just want us to see ourselves in this differently, to see our insides, the parts that we don't want to show people, the parts that we don't talk about often, the parts that we feel we have to cover and hide and keep away from the world in order to survive, in order to exist. I don't want to talk about my illness. I don't want to talk about my insecurities. I don't want to talk about how this thing really bothers me, but I need to, and I can only do that with some semblance of safety. I want this book to be a soft place to land, give our humanity breathing room.
Oh, I think you can make it that. I think we can. I think we can translate it, because collecting and sharing these stories is breath and space and the act of seeing people. I don't know what to make of this, but every time I read an essay, I had this really paradoxical experience of a deeper understanding of how much more I have to learn about the Black experience. Yet at the same time, I saw myself and felt deeply connected to the shared humanity of these yearnings.
That's so interesting, right? That's another reason why anti-racist work is important. You have to engage with Black humanity because the expansiveness of our humanity is so great that it reaches to other people. I don't want to sound all kumbaya and we're all just human beings, but we're all just human beings whose experiences and environments and these systems have affected in different ways. But we must tear away the layers and reveal the core, then work our way back from that.
Yeah. Yes. You know, and one of the things that I learned a lot about is the unrelenting nature of intergenerational trauma.
And that's not familial trauma. There are some things that have improved for Black people in the United States, and then there are other things that are exactly the same, but with new faces. Systems that have not necessarily improved, they just look different. And we just keep trying to reshape the same tools that we use to dismantle the ever-changing systems. It's very tricky. But I do think this is a great moment for us to stop and focus on and give real attention to what effective dismantling looks like and requires. We need specific attention and action, and not just general thoughts.
I think I even feel different after this conversation, to be honest with you.
You know, years ago, I went on a trip to Tunisia, and it was for this big conference. It was a delegation of folks from the United States, from all over. I met this woman named Ra. She was a Vietnamese woman who also did work against sexual violence, also with young girls. We just connected quickly and became fast friends. And in the course of 3 or 4 days of us just talking, I learned so much more about what Asian women, particularly the Vietnamese girls she worked with, have to deal with every day. There were very similar issues, very similar consequences, but very different reasons that explained how they arrived at the places they were. I had the same experience with another girlfriend of mine, Temori, a Dalit Indian woman who does work around sexual violence among her people. We always landed in the same places. We often carry our trauma in similar ways, but the roads that led us to the trauma are all so different. We must pay attention to that road. That road is our humanity. That road is the peace that we're talking about. A lot of times we're happy and relieved and find similarities. Oh, you too, me too, no pun intended. These experiences create community, and it's wonderful, but it is still critical to understand the very different paths that led you to the trauma.
That just makes so much sense to me. We have to know the road if we're going to walk back down it and dismantle the systems that lead us to trauma.
Exactly.
Between Us, A Reckoning with My Mother, written and read by Jason Reynolds. I was 13 when my grandfather's leg was amputated, above the knee. An infection, they said. Something nasty spreading throughout his body. My mother and I traveled 9 hours to South Carolina to ensure the oak tree of our family could sustain after losing a limb. I don't remember the ride to the hospital or the hospital itself, but I do recall him sleeping flat-backed in bed post-surgery, and my mother talking to the doctor, or maybe it was the nurse, about the dressing on the wound. A mound of gauze as if the base of what was left of his leg, now footless and blunt, had been fashioned into a giant Q-tip. My grandfather had been turned into someone else, someone I would never actually get to know, because he would never leave the hospital again. I was 13 when my grandfather's leg was amputated above the knee, and 13 when he died. His death would mark the end not only of his life or my mother's tangible relationship with her parents, my grandmother had passed 3 years prior, but also of our bi-monthly journeys to the South. It had become routine for my mother to get off work every other Friday, have my older brother Alan and me pack the trunk with duffel bags and a small cooler containing a few aluminum foiled turkey sandwiches, then give Alan a list of instructions of what not to do while we were gone, though she knew he wouldn't abide by a single word. But I suppose she figured his disobedience and absence was better than his persistent griping, which included tying each word to a disrespectful groan and taking everything in his life out on me by trying to take life out of me. Alan was afflicted with adolescence, and there was just too much ground to cover for my mother to deal with the futility of trying to cure him. Not to mention, at this point, my parents had come undone, and she was doing this alone. In the car, we'd listen to the radio, oldies, and I'd wait for my mother to ask the same question she asked every trip. "How you know these words? You weren't even born when this came out," she'd say. Or, "Boy, what you know about the Temptations?" Or Marvin Gaye, or Aretha Franklin, as if she hadn't been playing this music each day of my life. Their lyrics seemed to be spackled to the roof of my mouth, sharing space with the MCs of my time, an internal intergenerational residence and resonance. We'd pull into rest stops where I'd get peanut M&Ms or gas stations where we'd load up on 6 packs of peanut butter crackers my mother referred to as nabs to go with the turkey sandwiches, of course. Sometimes she'd even play a number. Out-of-town lottery felt luckier, she'd say. And whenever she'd get tired, whenever the hypnotic perforated line began to lull her to sleep, she'd crack the window and talk. My mother would sermonize about the importance of dreams and purpose searching, meditation, and energy. She'd say things about how she wanted me to live a grounded life, a centered life, and a life in flight all at the same time. Conversations she felt like she could have only with me, her child, a child, because the bulk of our family saw her crystals and smudging as the antithesis to their conservative views on God. "Some things are meant to stay between us," she'd say. My mother would tell me stories about growing up in a no-stoplight town on 200 acres of land acquired by her great-great-grandfather, who was a freedman, how his chosen name after emancipation was January, and how no one actually knew how he got the land, but everyone believed he somehow inherited it from the family who formerly owned him. He built a house on this acreage, but he only knew of 2 types of homes, slave quarters and the big house. And to build slave quarters was out of the question. So he built a house resembling the one of the family who had treated him as property. And he tilled the soil and planted vegetables, grew fruit trees, had hogs and chickens. He got married and raised children. One of those children, John Wesley, would inherit January's green thumb, making him the heir to the land. And as John Wesley grew older, he would eventually informally adopt his grandson, my grandfather, whose mother had abandoned him for a life in the North. John Wesley raised my grandfather as his own, taught him how to reap and sow, taught him the value of hard work and heredity, taught him family. When John Wesley died, he left the land and the house in my grandfather's care. And that's where my mother was born and where she'd live until she was 10 years old. It's where she learned to snap peas and pick cotton and pluck chickens. It's where she learned, as the middle child, how to take care of her older and younger sisters, the independent and dependable compass of a sometimes wayward siblinghood, where she, too, would learn family. That land is the same land my mother and I would pull up to in the middle of the night, the darkness of Carolina, a cataract to this country town. But the house wasn't the same house. It had burned down after my mother, aunts, and grandparents packed up and moved to Washington, D.C. for more opportunity in 1955. The farm had dried up, and the nation's capital, Chocolate City, was installing a new subway system and needed hands. So life in the country castle was traded for survival in a one-bedroom apartment in the projects. Once my mother and her sisters were all grown and had children of their own, my grandparents moved back to South Carolina, back home, to their land. My grandfather built a new, smaller house with his hands and used those same hands to wake up the dirt. Out came the collards, the mustards, the turnips and kale. Out came the watermelon, the cantaloupe, the tomatoes and butter beans. Before Alan was old enough to stay home by himself and before the divorce, we'd come down every summer as a family, my father taking the wheel, Alan and me in the back seat exchanging elbows. We'd had our first bouts with everywhere dust and our first tastes of squirrel, buckshot still in the meat. We'd gotten to know our cousins, trained our ears to decipher their drawls, and most important, were introduced to a part of our grandfather we'd never known. We'd only known a city man, but down south, we'd gotten to know a farmer, a giant who walked the rows, who sprinkled seeds and steered a tractor, a man who smashed melon on the ground and clawed the heart of it with his bare hands and passed it around to my brother and me like communion host. There was a tenderness to him, a different kind of tenderness, but a tenderness all the same. He wasn't one for hugs and kisses, but was always sure to thank his children and grandchildren for coming to see him. I know y'all busy with your own lives, and you don't have to think about me and your mother down here, he'd say. You're my father, my mother would reply, and you raised us to always put family first. Then he'd pull a $5 bill from his wallet, press it into my palm as if it were a nugget of gold, and say, split that with your brother. And when I'd complain about how ridiculous that seemed, seeing as I'd surely blow half of my share on peanut M&Ms on the way home, he'd say, don't matter. Y'all brothers. Family. I was 17 when my mother was diagnosed with cancer in her bladder. Caught it early enough, they said. It had eaten away at a part of her before she'd ever told me. But when she did, sitting across from each other at the kitchen table, I could see the bite marks, could see the fear in her eyes. Don't worry, she said. I'm gonna make it because I need to see you make something of yourself. I ain't going nowhere until then. So I was thrust into adulthood with a ferocity that seemed unfair and unforgiving, struggling with college classes, working a boring but paid internship, then going to the hospital to check on my mother, who was in and out of surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. I don't remember the daily ride to the hospital, and honestly, I don't remember the hospital either. But I do remember seeing just her head lifted above the horizon line of white sheets, her skin ashen and cracked, tubes beeping, and a spot of moisture always in the corners of her eyes. She'd squeeze my hand and nod just enough to let me know she knew I was there. When I'd leave the hospital, I'd return to my hot box of a dorm room where I'd write for hours. Those lyrics I grew up listening to, the rappers and crooners, had somehow, through some backdoor miracle, transmuted into a love of poetry. So every moment I wasn't in class, at work, or in the hospital, I'd be scribbling well-intentioned self-righteousness to be recited aloud at open mics. It became both a thirst and a therapy, on one hand stretching a hole wider, and on the other smearing salve on a wound. I look back now, and I wonder how much of it had to do with the weight of family complications, and how much of it was what my brother had, the affliction of adolescence, the natural irritation of growing up, let alone growing up Black. Either way, if it's true that you are what you do most, then over time, the writing thing started to crystallize. It started to take hold. And as it did, my mother's cancer started to let go, easing its grip on her life. I remember the doctor explaining to me the dressing on my mother's wound. There were things in her that had been extracted, parts of her no longer. She'd been turned into someone else, but she'd made it, which gave me the permission to leave. I graduated, packed a trash bag with clothes, jumped in a U-Haul with my college roommate, also named Jason, and headed to New York City to chase my dream of being a writer. An unavoidable cliche. I'll spare you the details of the mattress on the floor and the 40-ounce beers for dinner. What's more important to note is that 6 months into my life in Brooklyn, I'd landed a literary agent, which at the time felt like hitting the numbers. Like my mother always said, sometimes out-of-town lottery feels luckier. But the thing about luck is, I was 22. I was 22 when my mother was admitted to the hospital again, this time for vomiting and belly pain. Because of the previous surgeries necessary to remove the cancer and the constant cutting into her abdomen, an immense amount of scar tissue had formed and had somehow wrapped itself around her small intestine, pinching it, blocking everything from passing through. To correct it meant risking her life. A 12-hour surgery where any mistake could puncture the intestine and sepsis would bring on an infection she, according to the doctors, wouldn't survive. I boarded a Greyhound at Port Authority and took the 4.5-hour ride from New York City to D.C. to ensure the oak tree of this version of our family could sustain after losing bits of its bark. The trip seemed nothing like our rides down south when I was younger. No turkey sandwiches, no M&Ms, no nabs. Headphones took the place of car speakers blaring Sam Cooke, and there was a man sitting next to me taking up more space than should be legal. More space than Alan ever did. Also, a baby was crying. Also, the bathroom had an encyclopedia of excrement strewn across its surfaces. Someone was sick. There were no stories being told. So I told them to myself, told myself tales about how I'd willed myself into this position, how I'd bootstrapped and hoofed from city to city, stage to stage, a troubled troubadour who'd taken the hard road and now it was finally paying off. See, while I was going to be with my mother the day before her surgery, I'd never planned to stay. The trip was going to be a down and back, a quick turnaround. Because the day of the surgery was also the day I was supposed to sign my first publishing contract, the day my dream was to come true. I was 22 when I met myself. I don't remember much about the night before, about getting off the bus or who picked me up from the station. I don't even remember how I got to the hospital the next morning. Maybe I rode with her. Maybe my mother was already there and I rode with my aunt. What I do remember is just after the doctors prepped my mother for surgery, just before wheeling her down to the operating room, I was able to stand at her bedside, her face bare, the gold teardrop earring she wore every day absent, as was the red lipstick. "Ma, I want to be here, but today is the day I sign the deal. This is it, what I've been working for. Black boys don't get this kind of shot often. This is my purpose, my dream," I said, salivating at the thought of success. She nodded, told me to do what I needed to do. I kissed her on her forehead and was gone. At 22 years old, I left my mother in a potentially fatal surgery so I could do what could have been done a day, a week, even a month later. But I thought about how I'd never seen Black writers growing up, so there couldn't have been many, and if I didn't do it then, they'd retract the opportunity and I'd never get to see who I might become. Instead, I got to see who I already was. I'm 36 now. My mother and I have never talked about the intricacies of that surgery, and whenever I ask about it, she brushes it off. But I know what happened. I know things got shaky, that there were moments when her life teetered. But she made it. Again. And today, as I write this, she turns 75 years old. This morning, before sitting at my computer, I called her. We talked about how proud we are of each other and how our lives together have been nothing short of miraculous. I told her I was working on this essay and about the shame I carried for over a decade. It sat heavy in me like a dumbbell in my belly, dragged behind me like laces too long, an infection, something nasty spreading throughout my body. That was a long time ago, she said. I know, but sometimes I still feel it, I said. Baby, you gotta forgive yourself, she said, and went on to talk about how she raised me to go get what I desired, to go be who I wanted to be, to simultaneously live a grounded life, a centered life, and a life in flight. But above all, I taught you like my daddy taught me, family first. Right, and that's the reason and you've done that every day since. Why be ashamed of what you've atoned for? Once again, she was the independent, dependable compass pointing true north. And in that moment, this moment, I realized that perhaps I've scratched at the emotional laceration of shame, of selfishness. But if my mother is right, the itching isn't coming from infection anymore. It's coming from the fact I've never removed the dressing from the wound. You understand what I'm saying to you, son? She asked. I think so. Well, let me make it plain. Some things are meant to stay between us, but this ain't one of them. We talked for a few more minutes between tears and laughter until finally I had to go. Happy birthday, Ma. Thank you, baby. And thank you for calling me. I know you're busy with your own life, and you don't have to think about me, so I'm always grateful when you do. Of course, I chuckled. You're my mother.
Jason Reynolds is an award-winning and number one New York Times best-selling author. His many books include Stamped, Racism, Anti-Racism, and You, a collaboration with Ibram X. Kendi, Long Way Down, Look Both Ways, and the Track series. Most important, he loves his mother.
This Joy I Have, written and read by Austin Channing Brown. Our horror movie collection currently tops 300 DVDs. They are divided into sections. Zombies on the top, vampires in the middle, slashers on the bottom right. Hauntings line one side of the bookshelf, separated from the classics by a Freddy glove, Jason mask, and toy chainsaw covered in fake blood. We attend conventions where my husband can get autographed pictures of his favorite horror stars. When October falls, we do not decorate with pumpkins and candles the color of burnt orange, but with gray skulls and tombstones. Every couple of days, when we admire the crisp air or changing leaves, one of us will playfully whisper in an ominous tone, "The harvest is near." It's silly. And though there are a handful of horror movies that I ban from entering our home because they feel a little too real, mostly I have come to appreciate the momentary terror of a good scary movie. There's a comfort in the relative familiarity of their beginnings. A delightful group of family members or friends is having the time of their lives. There is laughter and joking, hugging and tenderness, and excitement for life hanging in the air. And then there is a split second when the good time seems too good to be true. A certain grimness slices through the merriment. There is now only before and after. It's a pattern that works because we intuitively recognize the jolt of fear that this is all too good to last. Parents feel it when the kids are happy and relaxed and snuggling. Partners feel it when love swells and overwhelms. Students feel it when everything seems to be breaking their way. Pet owners feel it when the cute little face of their puppy or kitten is too much to bear. Entrepreneurs and creatives feel it after securing the big deal. In the moments when we are filled with joy, we wonder if there is a haunting force out there that will soon steal our joy away. In her book, Daring Greatly, our friend Brené calls this phenomenon foreboding joy. She explains, "We're afraid that the feeling of joy won't last, or that there won't be enough, or that the transition to disappointment, or whatever is in store for us next, will be too difficult. We've learned that giving into joy is, at best, setting ourselves up for disappointment, and at worst, inviting disaster. And we struggle with the worthiness issue. Do we deserve joy, given our inadequacies and imperfections?" And so we find ourselves shrinking back from moments of joy. We recoil from the feeling, and to varying degrees from the people who bring us pleasure. We withhold excitement in exchange for the preparation of disappointment. We steel our hearts for tragedy, rather than softening into the vulnerability that joy makes us feel. I am certainly guilty of this. Whenever I talk with my only living grandmother, or even think about her for long, I worry that my joy means she will soon pass away. When my husband plans for me to have time to myself, I worry that he and my son will get into a car accident, all because I was excited to read a book without interruption. When I hug my father and breathe in the smell of his gray flannel cologne, I wonder if this will be the last time I feel his arms wrapped around me. It's a problem. And when I'm working toward recognizing, in order to practice embracing joy rather than repelling away from it, I follow up thoughts of my grandmother with a text message to her, even if we just got off the phone. I breathe deeply and squeeze my husband and son before they leave. I look my daddy in the eyes and tell him how much I love him. But I have discovered a far more despicable agent of foreboding joy in the form of racism. For Black people and other people of color, there is a level of apprehension that isn't wrought from an uneasy feeling of undeservedness, but from the knowledge that racism is the silent stalker, always willing to wring joy from our lives. This level of foreboding joy is not in our heads. It's in the evidence of our experience. As I type this, the world is in the midst of managing a global pandemic. It is common knowledge that in America, those who are elderly and Black are disproportionately more likely to die from illness. And so my worry is heightened for my grandmother. When my husband is in the car, I do not fear only the possibility of an accident, but the possibility of a police officer harassing him, maybe even taking his life. I'm all too aware that my father may not fall outside the statistics of Black men who have increased health problems compared with other demographics. For me and many Black people, the data revealed by systemic racism isn't a vague notion, but a real enemy that may turn and come after me at the moment when I'm too joyful to pay attention. Now that the weather is turning into fall here in the Midwest, my toddler has become obsessed with wearing a jacket. He will walk around the house pantsless, but with a jacket fully zipped up, hands comfortably and confidently in his pockets. The other day, we walked into the bathroom together. He placed his feet on his little plastic step stool to reach the sink, and then pulled on the hood of his fleece jacket before turning on the water. As I glanced at his reflection in the mirror, he looked just like a tiny Trayvon Martin. For a moment, I drifted into my head. Did Sabrina Fulton look at Trayvon the way I'm looking at you now, son? Does she have any idea her time with her boy would be so short? Will mine be? Will I lose you before you have a chance to become an adult? Will this racist country take you from me? I had to force myself to snap out of it, to stop rehearsing tragedy. I had to force myself back into the present moment, because this kind of foreboding is not the result of undeservedness, but the result of knowing that I do not possess an antidote to the effects of racism. White superiority, which lashes out in racism, is wholly uninterested in deservedness. It is persistent beyond poverty, beyond socioeconomics, beyond educational attainment, or even celebrity status. It does not care how hard you work or where you live. It is not interested in how you dress or speak. My skin means that I am always a worthy candidate to be the victim of white superiority and its tragic possibilities. I am not alone. Recently, I was part of a book club in which other Black women in the circle began to ask questions about how to keep back this thief of joy. A dark-skinned Black woman with long Senegalese twists wrapped in a bun atop her head said, "Austin, I have been unable to go for a walk since the death of Ahmaud Arbery. I love going on walks around my neighborhood, but I just can't bring myself to indulge." An Afro-Latina mom leaned forward. "Austin, I'm going on an epic RV trip with my family, but I'm so scared about driving through the areas that have long been known as sundown towns. I'm having trouble really getting excited." Another Black mother chimed in. "Austin, at this point, I'm afraid every time my kids go to play outside. What if they venture into the wrong neighbor's yard or driveway? I know I can't keep them cooped up inside, but I also can't enjoy them playing freely outside." As I listened to these women share about the specific ways their joy was being hampered by the ever-present reality of racism, I desperately wanted to assure them that everything would be fine. "Your walks are going to be sheer delight," I wanted to say. "You will encounter only kind travelers on your journey," I wanted to promise. "Your babies will be all right, no need to fear. Delight in their joy," I wanted to assure. But I couldn't. In good conscience, I could not declare with any certainty that racism wouldn't continue to act as the villain in any good slasher movie. It might not be outrun. What do you do when you are all too aware that Blackness makes you uniquely vulnerable in this world? Traditionally, the Black community has relied on a spirituality born of hardship and humanity, to declare a phrase popularized by gospel music artist Shirley Caesar. "This joy I have, the world didn't give it to me, and the world can't take it away." This is not to create a monolith of the Black community. I am in no way suggesting that all Black Americans have found refuge in the gospel of the Christian church. Instead, I mean only to point out a shared, rooted resilience and joy. Contained in this one sentence is a staunch declaration that if the world will take from me, it will do so only once, not twice. It cannot have both tragedy and my joy. This posture is not giving in to foreboding joy. It does not suggest that since racism can steal from me, I will care about nothing and no one. Instead, it lives paradoxically at the intersection of joy and pain, realistically acknowledging that pain may come, but that pain cannot permanently drown out joy. After generations of horrific oppression, after a century of second-class citizenship, after a host of atrocities from colonization to genocide and all manner of horrors, we have learned that the only thing white supremacy would love more than taking our lives is for the lives we have to be diminished, less than human, filled with despair, containing only fear. But our community has learned that even the darkest depths of human evil cannot snuff out our experience of joy, of laughter and love, of good food and good conversation, of family legacy and hope for the future, of creative endeavor and the pursuit of justice. the joy of Blackness persists. Our joy is in having loved and been loved well. Our joy is in the ties that bind us to one another. Our joy is in the legacy of all that our ancestors have done for us. Our joy is in being able to participate in that legacy now. Our joy is in the taste of freedom, regardless of whether we got only a morsel or the whole pie. Our joy is in a shared language, a shared dance, a shared game, a shared song. Our joy is in having left a mark in the world, being able to say, I was here. And none of these things can be placed in a box and buried in the ground. They are resilient in that they are everlasting, surviving long after the pain of tragedy has waned. There are very real ways our community attempts to keep the fear of tragedy away. A mother tells her son to pull his hood off before he enters the store. A partner reminds her wife to tuck the receipt away in case they are accused of stealing. Before leaving the house to walk the dog through the neighborhood, we double-check that we have ID to quickly end any accusations that we don't live in our own neighborhood. Even my husband and I, on our way to the hospital to deliver my son, sat in the car making plans between contractions. If something goes awry with my labor and doctors do not believe me, we'll make clear that you are an attorney and they should take us seriously. No need to tell them your specialty is juvenile justice. We do our best to anticipate the ways white superiority will pop up in our everyday. When the women in the book club asked me about the ways foreboding was inhibiting their lives, I asked them what parameters they could manage that might set their hearts at ease. For a little while, can you walk at a public park rather than in your neighborhood? Can you mark out your cross-country drive to stay in places as close to a major city as possible? Can you limit your kids to the backyard or the grass in your front yard just for this week? Let's see if we can box the feeling in, knowing that we will not live at the pinnacle of anxiety forever. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But we go on trying, we go on living, even if we are scared. We decide not only that we will practice gratitude for the ways we are experiencing joy, but that we will do so with every bone in our body. We will love hard. We will dance with abandon. We will laugh loudly and often. We will declare our right to be in that store or that school or that neighborhood or that job. We will give our bodies the respect they so richly deserve for carrying us this far. In the words of poet Toy Derricotte, joy is an act of resistance. And so we will lean into that joy, knowing that our humanity demands that we fully partake of this magical experience. When I look into my little boy's eyes and wonder if his life will mirror Trayvon's, I silently thank Trayvon Martin for his life and Sabrina Fulton for sharing his story. And I lean over to my little boy, kissing the top of his head. I let my heart swell with joy over his very existence in my life, for that little personality that is intrigued by zippers and pockets and hoods. I will love him harder, and in this become softer. I will be vulnerable, open to being hurt, because I trust that my joy in him cannot be taken away.
Austin Channing Brown is a speaker, writer, and media producer, providing inspired leadership on racial justice in America. She is the author of the New York Times bestseller, I'm Still Here, Black Dignity in a World Made for Whiteness.
Dirty Business, The Messy Affair of Rejecting Shame. Written and read by Tanya Denise Fields. I don't know a time I haven't felt guilty or ashamed. This has colored literally every decision I've made in my life. And the more I let it lead, the more I fucked shit up for myself, the deeper the well of shame got. I have felt ashamed of being dark, of having a broad nose, of my big lips, of my prematurely developed body, and later of my fat body with its rolls, saggy titties, hanging belly, and stretch marks. I have felt deep shame for not going to a better school, for not getting a good traditional job, for my struggles, for my literal hunger, for my six babies with four men who abandoned us. Sometimes I was ashamed of being the one who stayed. And all that shame ate me up, made me shrink, exhausted me, made me perpetually tired. A few years ago, I woke up, a 310-pound chain smoker with scratches around my neck, a bruised throat, and my eyes almost swollen shut from crying all night. My kid's father had almost killed me. Our union had added two more children to my brood. We lived in a shitty-ass apartment on Fox Street in a resilient and struggling part of the South Bronx. He was a ne'er-do-well corner boy who always fucked up his packs and came up short. And I was carrying the whole family. And even though I was his lover, surrogate mommy, and baby mama, he still had the wherewithal to become my abuser, emotionally, mentally, and physically, eventually almost killing me in front of my children after coming home from a two-year bid in New York State prison. I had long become used to being a punching bag or a doormat or a real live masturbatory tool for the romantic partners in my life. And I had long internalized the ways in which people in my family and my community saw me. Mammy. That word had been thrown my way for most of my adult life, especially after the birth of my second child, and I was keenly aware that most folks were comfortable using it because of the way I looked. My shame, my guilt for existing, for being viewed as ugly and undesirable, for surviving, has always been rooted in the way I look. It has not only lived in my body, it has been because of my body, and everything else has rippled out from there. And sitting there in the 41st precinct, being asked by some dismissive-ass white cop who couldn't be bothered to look me in my black-ass face why it took me so long to disclose, I just felt the most tired I had ever felt in my fucking life. What had shame gotten me? Shame doesn't course correct or compel folks to make better choices. I was living in a community full of women who felt shamed, who had been born from shame, who projected nothing but shame, and it did nothing for us. It had done nothing for me. Shame is a liar, a thief, a murderer of dreams and vision. It is a manipulator. It too is an abuser. I almost died in front of my kids, and I was tired, exhausted, cracked wide the fuck open and broken into a million pieces by shame. And here I was just holding my guts in my hands, and I got to see what I was made of. And it wasn't shame, it wasn't guilt, it wasn't ugliness, lack, or deficiency. I am magic, cocoa powder, shards of glass and shrapnel, and the deepest parts of my grandmother's imaginations. I am savory and sweet, salt, sugar, and lime, possessing the gentleness of the brightest lilies and the strength and temerity of the most destructive storms. Most important, I am worthy, and that was the critical shift. Language is important, and words mean things. The things they mean can have an insidious effect on how we see the world, ourselves, each other. We use this word deserving a lot, and we think we're really saying something. I deserve to be happy. I deserve a nice apartment. Or I deserve a healthy and successful relationship. But deserving is transactional. It means you did a thing, performed a thing, earned a thing. It requires you to do something in order to get something. And for most of my life, shame robbed me because I thought I didn't deserve shit. I had not performed respectability the way I was expected to. I made questionable decisions. I had too many children. I didn't earn enough money. I vacillated between working class and working poor, often needing the aid of safety net programs. And I lived in a world that told me from in utero that women like me don't deserve anything except heartache and pain because I was fat, because I was dark, because I was ugly by Western European standards, because I was fast and let older boys and grown men molest and rape me. This is the lens through which I saw myself, defined by others. That became my narrative. And I wore that coat like it was the only one I had, and every fucking day was freezing. In this moment of deep exhaustion, of public humiliation, of desperation, of near-death spiritual disembowelment, I decided that to save my own life and not leave my children an inheritance of shame, poverty, and guilt, I needed to disavow this idea of deserving. Joy, happiness, health, safety, love, and abundant community are inherent. You don't have to perform or do anything for anyone to get them. Imagine if we lived in a world in which this narrative was the one instilled in us instead of the capitalist, anti-Black one that roots us in lack, shame, guilt, and insecurity. Right there, in that chair, in that cold precinct, sitting next to this flushed, smug asshole of a cop, I decided to reclaim what was inherently mine. I didn't owe shame shit, but it owed me everything. I had finally bridged my political analysis with my real life experience. I had to contend with the reality that I had allowed shame to stifle any type of self-love and respect I should have had for myself. I had spent most of my life conceding that I was a trash can, only good for receiving the worst from folks. I felt physical pain finally confronting the hard truth that this was the example I set for my children. And I asked myself, if you can't love yourself enough to turn this around, do you love your children enough? It was that love that propelled me forward on this journey. As cliche as it sounds, it was the love of my children and my desire to model for them what had not been adequately modeled for me that steeled my resolve to free myself. That night, I had a family meeting with my 6 kids, and we decided we were ready to leave, to go anywhere, but we would not suffer in the shitty apartment anymore. Through tears and silence and laughter, we packed whatever we could carry, loaded up my 15-year-old Honda Odyssey, and drove to the PATH Homeless Assessment Shelter, a homeless intake center. And in front of another dismissive man, a Black one this time, I disclosed that I was a survivor of domestic violence. For 2 days, we suffered in that place. And for 4 months, we dealt with the abusive Department of Homeless Services. After leaving the PATH Center and being assigned to a transitional housing unit, I was subjected to curfews, to random folks letting themselves into our unit and checking our belongings, to roaches and mice, to fights in the building. It was awful. And quite often, I asked myself what the fuck I had done. I could feel that old frenemy shame sneaking up on me, whispering in my ear how disgusting I was, how I had made yet another poor decision, how I deserved everything I was getting. It took everything I had to push it down, to swallow it, and then throw it up, to purge it. So finally, after 5 years of suffering in this toxic and codependent relationship, I publicly disclosed on social media that I got my ass kicked on a regular basis, that I was often coerced into sex, that I was cheated on with impunity, that I was called names and put in harm's way, that my children had viewed some of this, and that I allowed this not only in this relationship, but in others. Because I was nurtured in a world that instilled shame in me from the time I was birthed, and probably well before. Before that disclosure, I had kept the inner workings of my private life a secret. I was comfortable sharing with thousands of followers on social media and hundreds of people I encountered during speaking engagements, very candid insight into my life as a mechanism for dismantling respectability politics. But up until this point, I could never fathom sharing that I was a victim and survivor of intimate partner violence. I believed that in doing so, I would seem weak, stupid, and fraudulent. Smart women, physically large women like me, aren't victims. And on top of that, it would seem like an admission to the very loud detractors that I was, in fact, a walking mess of a stereotype. I finally, without apology, verbalized that I ain't felt like I was much of anything for a good long while, and that it was not some personal failing, but a natural result of a world laden with fat antagonism, colorism, toxic ideas around sexuality, respectability politics bullshit, and whopping doses of racism. And when all these things intersected, it made for a perfect low self-image cocktail. I didn't have low self-esteem, as if it were something I had just picked up in the supermarket. This was inherited. This was nurtured. This was force-fed to me through passive words, casual slaps, and cyclical violence. It was normalized in media tropes and schoolyard taunts. It was insidious and invisible, but always present and consistent. And the irony was that it was shame that created this, and it was shame that made me feel as if I could not openly verbalize and confront this and ultimately heal. But fuck that, I said. Rebuke shame. So I said it loudly. I said it often. I was insistent. I was unrelenting. And then my sisters came out of the shadows, empowered and vulnerable, sharing narratives of violence, hurt, and the shame that was always right there. Not really below the surface, but subconsciously always moving the hand that led our lives. I was in turn empowered, and I found a powerful voice I didn't realize was there. I saw my reflection, what we were and what we could be. Suddenly, I realized that happiness didn't have to be aspirational,